Okay, good morning. Can you hear me? Yes. So today we have this lecture 11. So it is corresponding to the chapter 11. This lecture is also the last one in the semester for this course. You may also notice that we still have chapter 12 and we don't have this time to go for that. So that could be assigned to you for reading as your homework. So this lecture is about today. This lecture is about the personnel aspects in the context of information security. When we talk about the personnel aspects, personnel management in information security, we may have heard a lot of sayings. For example, people saying, you may heard that people saying human factors are very important to information security, or say human beings is regarded as the weakest link in the information security chains. Or sometimes we say information security problem is largely a management problem instead of a pure technology problem. So all of these points to these aspects. So we call it the personnel aspects. So basically we'll talk about these topics in this couple of hours. First, we care about how to find the suitable candidate to fit a information security position in your organization. So this is from the perspective of an organization. And if you're going to find a suitable person, you need a series of criteria or sometimes metrics to measure and find the best matched one. And then we may need some metrics like professional credentials or say professional certificates a candidate can have. So it could be a common ground that everyone or say most of the people in this industry, in this field, accept such certificates, such standards, then they could be very convincing the candidate have this certificate. And also we talk about the employment policies and practice. So it is to tell us how to implement the recruitment process to integrate the information security component to the, for example, the people hiring and other employment process. And if we consider the human aspects, if we consider the workers in this context for example, an organization, we may think from two sides. One side is inside, so it could be permanent employee, and the other side is outside. Sometimes you have just temporary employee or say contract researcher or workers for your company or institute. Or sometimes it is even a consultant or some outsourced services. So we need to consider the difference between these two aspects. And we talk about this consideration for non-employees and also internal controls. Finally, we think about how to secure, or we have this necessity to secure the personnel data. It is not always the requirement of organization, but in most of countries, I mean EU countries, including Norway, it is a law requirement. So organizations, they should respect this to protect the sensitive data from their employee. And sorry. If we still have some time today, we go for some video clips from YouTube, tell us how to train the employees in this security awareness training. It was given by a chief security officer from Central California. So the first question, suppose you are a new employee in one organization. It could be here the university or a company, software company, or manufacturing company, engineering company, or hospital. I don't know what is the status, but from our perspective, you should have a series of information security training in the first few weeks. And suppose if you stand from the position of a non-information security expert, what could be the response from you? I guess for a non-expert or non-information security people, it might be quite boring or sometimes worrisome, right? And our textbook, they described several situations. For example, the employee may feel threatened. We talk about the information security, and for example, during the first week, the new employee will receive a 1 day or 2 days training for information security or security policies, how to master the security controls, and be notified of different information security incident situations you must report and how to handle with them. You may have this feeling everything is under the control of the security team. So what I'm doing now is monitored, and my communications is monitored, and it is a feeling of threatened. It could be also, if you have no some knowledge of information security, you think, okay, this type of training is fine because it is important, but still it is not my core job business, so it could be quite boring. Or sometimes the new employee are prompted by, for example, the security policy changes in every month or every half a year. For example, here in the campus, I'm an employee here. Before we use a system, financial system provided by SAP, and we were prompted to change our already complicated password every month, and it could not be very similar to the old password, and it is really pose some troubles for us. And sometimes the very tight security controls just drive the employee mad. And you may have your own different feelings. And here, if we talk about the feelings, this is something out of our textbook, but I feel it is necessary for us to know from the psychology perspective, what is the people's response? How we define what is response from people from the psychology perspective? If we look at the horizontal axis, we call it valence. This is one dimension of emotional, or we say psychological response of a human being to a thing, to an event. And what is valence? It is indicate you like it or not. So, or say something, the event is attractive to you, or it is evasive, you want to avoid it. And another axis, it is, we call it intensity, or arousal, the strength of the response. You feel it, you are strongly impacted by this change, by this information security policy, or you're just indifferent. You're okay, you're fine. So divided by these two axes, we can find these four different areas. It could be bored, it could be just relaxed. I think most of the cases in our daily life, if you have information security incidents or policy to implement it or security control for you to learn, you may feel bored if you are not a security people, or if you are security people, you are relaxed, but still, you are not so motivated to use a lot of time to engage with it. And sometimes people get worried. We say also depends on what type of security controls you are going to use. or say what type of information security incidents you are facing. If you have very heavy security constraints, it just makes people angry because it will reduce the usability in most of cases. But if we talk about this response, we say it could be happened just in normal days. But think about what could be the case for these two situations. Any people have any idea? In which situations? Yes. Yes, that is a good situation. But if it is because of the usability or convenience, why do we have this difference? Worried, angry, and it also makes the people happy. If it is convenient to use, it will be always make the user happy. But here, heavy security constraints. If it is convenient, it is hard to imagine why it will make people worried. So any other explanation or idea in which situation people will feel it is still very happy to use very heavy security constraints? That is actually the opposite aspects of in normal days. We say in abnormal days, for example, if you have really serious incidents, you are now for the moment under attack. And at this moment, I think the organization, they care less about the usability of the system, but care about the protection, right? If the protection is in depth, multiple layers, it's very heavy in security constraints, it will make very difficult, make the attacker very difficult to launch a successful attack. So the employee will be happy because it will reduce their responsibility or liability in this case, right? Similar case, if at least you should have some basic security constraints that make your employee relaxed in the such a case facing attack. So in general, the usability and the user experience could be very important when we design the concept and the technology of information security in this case. You can see from this. Then we think about the solutions. We talk about people may feel threatened. People may deem information security as a site work. People may think very tight information security policy and the controls will drive them mad. And what could be the solutions? For example, if you are a CISO, what type of solution can you come up to, for example, the first concern, if your employee feel threatened? Any idea how to, yes? Yes, transparency, very important. You have to be very clear about the rights and the obligations to make the new employee know everything, their rights and obligations from the first day during orientation. Yes, I will agree. And other idea? Yes, for example. Yes, we can use some bad examples, real life examples, to educate them, right? If you do not implement these security policies, you may have these consequences and you may be liable. And yes, we say clarification of the policies to make every people know the policy. And also, I think another aspects is we should be, as a security people, we should serve our colleagues in a very helpful attitude, not always in a supervisory status, right? You should do this, you should do this. Otherwise, we will be fined or fired or something like that. You should be a little bit kind to let your colleagues know you are really helping them to reduce their liability. And what could be the solution to dim it to the feeling people did regard it as a sight word? And just now, I think we have already an answer. For example, we can do security awareness training to people to use the real information security incidents to make people at least aware of these consequences. And also, very important aspect here, at least as the first point, the top management, they should clearly clarify this, set the information security as one of the fundamental objectives of the organization. Otherwise, you don't have the support of management, you will be frustrated always. Solutions to the feeling being driven mad by the changes. Let's say every people, no people like changes. If you are demanded to learn the new things every week, we change the security policies every week, and no people can survive in this situation, right? So to avoid this to a large degree, we have to think about the information security concept design, technology design, policy design from the very early phase and involve the users. So that is we called in the first lecture or the second lecture, that is the SDLOC methodology, right? So in the SDLOC circle, in each step, we collect the feedback from the user and use it to improve our design. And okay, we come back to another topic we called the personnel. Another aspect of personnel management is how to find the correct person. So the first question is whom to find. So the answer is we should find a person with education, training background, and experience in information security. The second question is where to place such information security staffs. Our textbook suggests the following options. You may place our information security staffs in IT functions. I think this is a normal case. The same thing happened here, right, in our campus. And if your organization does not really deal with some digital things, you're more dealing with hard or things or well or other goods, may put it under the Department of Physical Security also. And some organizations, they prefer, they establish the branch which is governed by their administrative officers. Or depends on their services of different organizations or companies. It can be in insurance department or legal departments. However, we just think about the first case, and which is also the widely deployed case. Information security is closely affiliated to the IT department. I think this is a very typical case in many organizations. Then we do have some debates you may find from our textbook. The debates is traditionally we have this position or we have this idea because information security, first it is a information things, and we talk about IT security, IT. So they should be very close to each other. And the CISO or the information security function should be a part of IT function or IT department. So this is a very traditional position. It is also easy to understand. And in this case, CISO reports to CIO. However, think about the trend. People think, another group of people think, we do see actually some conflict of interest between general IT operation and information security. For example, if you are a CIO, Chief Information Officer, you may more care about the efficiency of IT operations in your organization, right? But not always, or I would say in many cases, information security will reduce the efficiency of the IT operation. So you do see, we do see this is a conflict in interest. And in this case, should we really demand the CISO to report to CIO? This is arguable. And we see more and more, actually, more and more organizations, they want to put these two roles or two departments in the parallel status. But still, currently, they were not easy to set them completely. So they are very closely cooperated. And yes, this is the argument we mentioned just now. Some people think the people who do and people who watch should not report to the common manager. So this is the reason currently there's a trend. People put the two departments in the parallel status. However, we still see different opinions here. For example, we can... Oh. Okay. Unexpected information security incidents. Copy and paste.
So here's the problem. The majority of CISOs report to the CIO, and the majority of those that do wish they didn't. They have two primary arguments. Firstly, that they require complete control over their own budget, and that it should not be part of the IT budget. And secondly, that there is a potential conflict of interest between CIOs and CISOs. An example of the latter can be found in the company attitude towards BYOD, bring your own device. If business demands it, IT can provide it. This can happen without any reference to security, and yet BYOD is one of the biggest security issues that any company faces. Indeed, you could argue that the whole problem of shadow IT arose because security was not sufficiently involved in the evolution of BYOD. Most security commentators and experts also recommend the dissolution of the CIO-CISO relationship. This has been standard advice for more than a decade. Nevertheless, in 2010, Symantec published figures suggesting that 72% of CISOs still report to IT. And this is not far off the current figures from Wisegate, suggesting that around two-thirds currently do so. So why is there such a demand for and resistance to change? Insight spoke to two CIOs, themselves members of the Wisegate community, to see what they think. John Oborne is CIO at the Niagara Frontier Transportation Authority. He believes that it is right for the CISO to report to the CIO. The roles, responsibilities and functions of the CISO and security department, he told Insights, are tightly coupled with other areas of IT, infrastructure, network, etc., all under the direction of the CIO. Having the CISO and security department outside of IT would inherently create finger-pointing and conflicts. In other words, the CISO's conflict of interests argument is correct, but the wrong way round. On the other hand, Gary Bailey, CIO at Penn Virginia, an oil and gas company, takes just the opposite view. I believe, he told Insights, that IT security must report to IT, CIO, because there are so many interdependencies between the technical infrastructure, telecom network, core business systems, and software security systems. One can cause the other to conflict in a technical computing environment. There must be one person who can knowledgeably make final decisions for the greater good of the entire computing landscape. Otherwise, companies will end up in a finger-pointing exercise when problems and issues are encountered, and it will be very difficult to ascertain responsibility and follow-up actions post-issue or problem or breach. In claiming authority, both CIOs accept responsibility. But if the work of IT and security are so closely bound, notice that it is traditionally IT security and has only recently become cyber security, do we even need a CISO? Could the CIO cover both IT and security? Bailey thinks not. Cybersecurity, he told Insights, is very much a growing problem that needs tremendous focus and the implementation or monitoring of countermeasures. I do not believe the CIO can provide both functions, mainly due to time constraints required for understanding, implementing, and monitoring countermeasures and dealing with other areas of IT that have similar risk. And Oborne agrees. It is too much for the CIO to perform both. It is more than I can handle in addition to the rest of my duties, and we only have 400 users. But that, of course, does not include the millions of public transport users within his transport authority. There's a difficult balancing act here. The person in charge of security needs to be able to communicate with the heads of all other business units. Getting time in the diaries of the C-suite is going to be much easier if head of security is also a C-officer. Senior vice presidents are not going to have much time for the security manager, so the head of security has to be called Chief Information Security Officer for the role to work. I personally think, said Oborne, stressing that it is just his opinion, many times it's the CISO's agenda to have a perceived higher visibility in the organisation because of the title. But what about the budget argument? CISOs believe that they need control over their own budget, separate to IT, to be able to operate effectively. Oborne says simply that if we're talking about IT or cybersecurity, it has to be part of the IT budget. He does not believe that either the CIO or the CISO should be responsible for non-IT forms of physical security, unless there is no alternative. Bailey agrees. The security budget, he says, should be part of the IT budget since it is directly related to the conduct of electronic computing and communication in every company. But he doesn't think this should be a problem. Certainly the CISO branch or cost centre of IT should have its own budget, goals, objectives, metrics and so on that roll up to the overall cost of IT to a company. This is not very different to the help desk branch, applications development and support branch, or data centre operations branch that all roll up to the CIO. It seems clear that from the CIO's point of view, the CISO reporting to the CIO is a no-brainer. And that would indeed explain why it is still the status quo after many years of an independence campaign. But there is possibly another reason for the CISOs seeking to come out from the shadow of the CIO. CIOs sometimes joke that the true meaning of their acronym is career is over, and it is difficult to see where you go after being in charge of IT. CISOs are unlikely to be happy reporting to a position that can go no further.
Here you get different opinions just because why? The two persons he interviewed are CIO. And if we talk about the relationship between CISO and the CIO and the function relationship between information security and the general IT operation, it's always relevant to budget, how the budget can be planned, how the budget can be controlled by different departments, and also the responsibilities, how this responsibility can be distributed. So there's no standard answer in this case. It really depends how the organization, how they set up the priorities and how they feel the communication channels could be efficient or not. And talk about the communication channels, we may have to think about besides the structure, the position, the status between the information security department and the IT generation department. We also think about how the reporting structure could be like, because this is the real mechanism how information security can be detected and responded in real life. One case, very simple case. Suppose an employee detect the information security incident. So the simple case is just he or she just report the incident to the security teams, right? Or another case is normally the project manager, your manager or group manager, does not like your team member to report direct to the C-levels. So this happened a lot actually in real life, because the manager should supervise all the activities of the group. So another option is the employee will report to the project manager, to his or her managers first. And the manager can be used as a filter to judge if this is a false alarm or this is really something we should report. And also, in the same time, the manager feels this is really his or her duty, job. Is there any other option? Or just the employee can report in parallel to the security teams, or and in the same time to the manager. Well, this is a little bit tricky in this case, how to distribute the responsibility, who is really going to take the responsibility to make a decision. And actually, we have some reference model from NIST. Say, in the US, CERT, the Cyber Emergency Response Team, how they report information security incidents. They have this reporting structure saying each agency must designate a primary and a secondary POC with US CERT and report all the incidents consistent with the agency's incident response policy. And what is the POC here? Any people know what is a POC? Yes, point of contact. So in this case, we designated this job to a special employee, still within the same group, managed by the group manager, but he has some special duty to watch for the incidents and make this incident report in a correct way, in the same time to the manager and in the parallel to the security teams. And this person must have some knowledge and basic capability to make a preliminary judgment, right? This is a false alarm, or this is something that they really need to take care. Anyway, the principle to reporting structure design is we have to achieve the balance of the two aspects. One aspect is as an information security officer or team member, you have a functionality to supervise your colleagues or employees to make them be compliant to the policy. So you are standing in a supervising position. In the same time, you are still colleagues. So you deliver your service. You deliver information security as a service. You help them to establish a information security culture. So that is a workmate position. You have to make this balance, not go to very extreme situations. We talk about the security policies reporting structure, and then we also think about the qualifications and requirements from the organization perspective. For example, the first level, we think about how the management level, they should respond to information security regarding the personnel management aspects. So we say management needs to know more about the security, skills, qualifications, financial needs, and the impacts. And the organization must be very clear in their mind what type of people they are looking for. It is a generalist of information security, or it is a specialist. And in most cases, actually, especially for SME, small companies, organizations, like in Norway, There were seldom very, very large-scale companies. Then organizations actually looking for a generalist with a common understanding, a very wide spectrum of information security knowledge. They should know how organizations operated and what is the basics of information security. On the other hand, if you look at the job descriptions and if you take a look at the candidate CVs, the candidates like to promote themselves as a specialist. For example, they have some certificate, they have how many years experience, working experience in a very specific topic. It's very important to make this balance. So you should be very clear about your target, what type of people you are looking for. Here we have a list of hiring criteria given by our textbook, and I think we are not going to worry details. This is a set of criteria and metrics how an organization they should compare different use to compare different candidates. And this is a structure given by our textbook, what could be the structure of positions in information security. Yes, under the CISO, we can find the different positions like information security manager, physical security manager. Under the information security manager, we have security administrators and also technician engineers. And on the other hand, under the physical security manager, we have the positions like physical security officers. Besides this permanent staff, we may have some consultant, external, outsource the positions. Other job titles, we can also see, for example, the security architect, security specialist. I see some of you almost close your eyes, so this is quite a boring part. You actually can read from our textbook the definition and the obligations of CISO and CEO. I will not go to very details. To just give you some funny things to see to keep awake. No. You know, we use a lot of information security training, awareness training. One of the major topics is how to manage the password, right? Sorry, this is a little bit off the track of our lecture, but just for fun.
Last night I was flipping around through the channels and I saw this. I really love infomercials. I don't know if you love them as much as I do, but I found one. It's a new product that I want to share with you. And, if you have a hard time remembering your online passwords, a lot of people have a lot of different passwords. This is going to solve your problem. Online passwords.
Very nice idea. Huh?
life and I'll figure it out. Oh my God, can you believe that? It's crazy. It's just a phone book. That's what it is. If you see an infomercial you think I should see, send it to me. I love these things. We'll be right back after this.
Okay, 5 minutes break. We'll come back. Okay, welcome back. And we have used almost 1 hour talking about only one thing, the sales, CI, CISO, and the function of information security, the relationship to the IT general operations. And now we talk about another topic. If you are finding a candidate, best match the candidates, think about the one objective metric. Of course, we can have a lot of subject metrics. Depends on the job interview officers, how they think about the candidates according to their personal experience. But from the perspective of objective criterion, we can use, we say, professional credentials, professional certificates. And now many information security organizations, they are seeking recognizable certifications. And in our textbook, you can find a lot of several of them in the mainstream certificates issued by different information security associations. And I do remember I have some colleagues here. They have some information security certificate, like a CISM. Another aspect is most of existing certification, they are relevant, quite new and not fully understood by hiring organizations. The certifications from this ISC and also ISAC. I have some colleagues, they have this certificate from CISA and the CISM. I will not go to details, including other certification programs provided by different non-profit organizations or some industry companies as well. One important thing is, if you already have these 2 pages of paper, and during the process, you are finding a candidate, you need this publish this job description. And normally, so far, the status is not so many people, they care about information security. But as we are information security people, we should do this work as an evangelist to promote the concept of integrating information security concept to the job description. And here, for example, we should review and update all the job descriptions in our organizations from the perspective of information security and cybersecurity, but in the same time to avoid revealing sensitive information to the, we say, prospective or say future employee, because it has not been fixed whether they can be employed here or not during the interview phase. A small exercise, you have this 2 pages of paper, and you are required to list the 3 top information security knowledges and skills. Here you have this list. Yeah, it is not a exhaustive list. You can also propose your criteria metrics or knowledge points or fields, skill fields. And the background is, look at this position, published position. And this is a real position and published by Nordea. I think the deadline is end of next month. So you still have a chance to get a job. Think about the 3 top information security knowledge or skills required by this position. Because they didn't mention any information security requirement there, but think from your perspective in this case. You may have 5 minutes, then we may have a poll, and then we can find out what are the most voted 3 information security knowledge and skills. Okay, let's have a poll of different fields, different requirements you preferred. First of all, I have a question. Do you have any other suggestions outside of this list? Any people have any other? For example, you think other technical detail skills or other requirements relevant to information security you prefer, which is not on this list. Just indicate that. Okay. It is not that case. Then we just poll on these different aspects. So first, security and the privacy regulations. How many people want to vote for this? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, okay. Security standards. 3, 4, okay. Software security. Hardware security? No. Okay. Cryptography? 1. Intrusion detection? 1. Wow, okay. Firewall? No. Network and communication security? 4. Authentication and identity management? 5. Access control? 6. Biometrics? No. Privacy enhancing technologies? 1, 2. Okay. Risk management? 6. Social engineering? 1, 2, 3. Okay. Security planning? You don't think we need to plan the security in this case. Physical security? No. Culture and the user experience? Okay. Finally, what are the top 3? Intrusion detection. And software security. And culture and risk management. Okay, so this is our result of statistics. Any people have any objection or say different opinion? Say I strongly object to this, or you have some reasons to explain or... Okay, no. Basically, I will agree to, yes, software security, intrusion detection, risk management, this is our general. For almost all the information security project, we need to consider this. And this as well. If I would want to add something, it could be also database security or something like that, right? Or say also depends on the services, how they want to use this big data model, how they want to use this data. If they want to outsource this data to another service providers, say this is Nordea, they have their customer, maybe customer data, statistics, like the user habit or something like that, or their financial data, they want to do some data mining to find some pattern they can use to increase their profits. They want to, they may outsource this to another data analytics, which is provided by an external party. In this case, I would also vote for the privacy enhancing technology. In this case, you have to use some technique like anonymization or pseudonymization technologies or secret sharing. Okay, we continue. Other considerations if we want to make a precise or feasible employment policy or practice. We think about it during the interview. Interview could be a good chance. We use it to educate our HR people because during normal days, you don't have a requirement to enhance the intensity of the training to our HR people. Normally, they are not the technical experts. And in this case, if you are going to look for some candidates, the HR must be equipped with some information security knowledge. So this is a good chance to educate our internal people. And we need to pay attention to limited information and physical leakage to the interviewees. Also, we need to do background check for the candidates, including something we can already see from the CV, like the identity, education, work experience, reference. Sometimes you make a phone call to the reference and to cross-validate the facts of this person. And if it is possible, and if it is legal, you can also do some background survey about something that normally not on the paper. For example, the motor vehicle records, drug history, credit history, criminal or civil court history, others. And employment contract. This is something we want to promote as an evangelist to insert, to integrate the information security perspective or concept into the job contract. And we also need to pay attention to the new hire orientation sessions. And how to do this, here you may find a example.
Fredag 25. November har vi fantastiske Black Friday-tilbud hos Claes Olsson. Finn det du trenger.
Hello there.
Hello, sir.
I forget to bring my access card. Can you please let me come with you?
Yes, please. You can follow me. Finally, a break. Hello there.
Hello, aren't you the new technician? I was wondering if you could remove encryption policy.
Sure. Let's go to the office.
Thank you very much.
So such short videos
looks like someone left their laptop unattended
to teach the employee rather than just
I am removing the policy.
Text the descriptions.
Hello, Adam here. How can I help you?
I am Lisa from finance. I forget my password. Can you please reset it?
Hold on, ma'am. Are you Lisa Johnson?
Yes.
Lisa, I have reset your password to Minisoft. Don't forget to change it.
Thanks.
Hello, sir.
Yes, please.
I need to fix the table. Can you please leave your table for a moment?
That's all right.
Looks like nothing is encrypted. I can get all data now.
Hello, sir. Our data has been breached. The new guy Adam is to be blamed for this. Can you send him to my office now? Adam, boss has called you in his office right now. Adam, you are fired. You are in lots of trouble now.
So that is just an example. Using cartoon or videos always gives your employee better feeling than a just a 100 pages of document of security policies. Other considerations we think about not limited to new hires, also the on-the-job security training, which is also very important. If we say for new hire, we need to launch a series of information security awareness training. We call it, what is that? Due care, right? Which is something we need to do. It is our duty to do that. And for on-the-job employees, we should keep this happen frequently, not just once per year. Normally people attending a training and the influence could be just a few weeks. After that, people forgot everything. So you should keep it happened periodically. And for example, by trainings, also by seminars, we can invite the expert from external, just like our NIST lecture. They can use their personal experience to give you real life stories and strengthen your impression of information security. And what is this called? Do you forgot this? Due diligence, right? And for also we can consider to incorporate the information security components in the evaluation of employees' performance, let's say as one indicator in the KPI or other evaluation index. And a very important aspect of information security employment policy is the job termination. So during the process, an employee is leaving the company, you need to update the information system, the physical and the digital access control as soon as possible. And if it is necessary to physically escort this person outside of the premise, not just like this person to wander everywhere to get information, to exploit. And also you may consider to hold a exit interview, a short meeting with this person to remind this person of the some requirement in information security after they quit the job. And we have to prepare for hostile departures. Some employees, they are really, we say, disgruntled employee. They are not upset, not happy with the employer. They may do bad things. We should have some policies, security policies in advance, in place, be in place to prepare for those cases. And we consider the non-employees, for example, temporary workers, contracted workers, consultants, business partners. And in most of these cases, one thing you need to keep in mind, normally people use is we call the NDA, non-disclosure agreement. And here we can get a quick look at what is NDA and why it is important.
I'm technology and business attorney Craig Delsec, and today's frequently asked question is, when do I need a non-disclosure agreement? Let's say you have a brilliant idea for a revolutionary product or service. You want to attract potential investors and partners, but still protect your light bulb moment from being stolen away. No problem, you think. I'll just get myself an NDA. We'll stop right there. NDAs serve a purpose. They protect confidential information and trade secrets. But take a closer look at the situation. These are people you've never worked with before. Isn't it a little too early to reveal your trade secrets and give them a peek under the kimono? You don't want to demonstrate your technology, and in doing so, disclose your secret sauce. If a demonstration gives it away, then show the people something else, perhaps the problem you're seeking to address. Once you're more confident about your partners and ready to get serious, that's the time to consider an NDA. Here are three most important things to keep in mind when considering an NDA. First, never rely on a form NDA. They're trickier than you think. I've seen NDAs that prohibit the disclosure of your secret, but don't limit the usage of the confidential information. So you think you're protected, but you're really not. Second, distinguish trade secrets from confidential information. They are not the same thing. Trade secrets are the most valuable confidential information of your business. Usually, restrictions on using confidential information have an expiration date. But trade secrets, on the other hand, need to be kept secret forever. Trade secrets are usually those things that have an economic value to your company and that your company takes reasonable steps to protect, kind of like the formula to Coca-Cola. Lastly, whenever possible, avoid revealing your trade secrets, because when they're out, they're out. You can't put the toothpaste back into the tube. I'm Craig Delsec, nyccounsel.com, reminding you, your ideas are as free as the wind unless you hire the right attorney.
So this video gives some short information what is NDA and which aspects we need to pay attention. For example, I can also share you with some real examples here in the college. Every year we have some visitors outside of the NTNU. It could be even outside of the EU scope, from US, from Japan, from China. They visit here, they have some collaboration in research projects. And the thing is, you have to be careful to draw this line, what type of information you should keep as confidential, especially for internal people, and what type of information you should keep as public information you can share with our visitors. Another case is we have also visiting students, for example, from Spain, from Germany, every year here. They are involved in our research, in the research lab activities, and you also need to sign an NDA with them to clarify what type of information you have right to use and what type of information you don't have the right to use or distribute it after the project finished. So do be careful, pay attention to such NDAs when you are dealing with external people. Well, you need to work together with them, cooperate with them. Talking about the internal control. So just now we talked about how to deal with visitors, external people, temporary workers, contract workers. Also, we need to think about the internal control, which is to prevent the information leakage from our inside. We call it the inside attack. So the basic trick our textbook talk about is the separation of duties. The simple understanding is if a task need to be done and it is better, you split this task to two parts and assign them to multiple people. And in this case, different people, it is very hard for just one people to cover the whole cycle of this thing. And this is a good preventive measure against the information leakage. So we call the separation of duties, or some people call it a segregation of duties. They are almost the same. Take a look at this one.
So when you see this term, S-O-D, with a little O, what does it mean? Well, it can mean two different things, separation of duties, but sometimes you may also see it written as segregation of duties. And basically, no, it means the same thing. In political terms, it actually be referred to as separation of powers. Now, if you live in the United States, separation of power is a big deal with the Constitution, meaning that the executive branch, the legislative branch, and the judicial system all have different powers and checks and balances and things that keep it in check. Well, that basically is what separation of duties or segregation of duties is about as well. It's about ensuring that the right people have the right access, but not enough access to bypass any other controls. And controls will be a big word that we'll discuss or that we'll use in this. Let's take an example here. We've got a person who, let's say he's in a role, and we're going to call this vendor payables. So it's a person who can actually come through and make out checks to vendors. We also have an individual or a role defined in the system for vendor management. Now, this particular individual is the company, or the people who occupy this role, I should say, are individuals that can come in and define the different vendors. So they create who the vendors are, and this person over here, occupants of this role, then are allowed to make checks or payments to them. Now, let's take an example here, and we're going to have Bob, because I call everybody Bob in these examples. So I have Bob here, and I'm going to make Bob a occupant of this role. So now he can come through and he creates vendor XYZ Inc. And now that this person's inside of there, this particular vendor can submit invoices for particular tasks for certain things. Now, here's where separation of duty comes into play. It's fine to allow Bob to do this, but if I also made him an occupant of this role, well, what can he do? Well, Bob would now be able to go and authorize payment to those invoices. And on the surface, it doesn't look like that big of a deal, except that if we consider that Bob now has the ability to create fictitious companies, such as XYZ, we'll call this fictitious, maybe we should call it Fictitious Inc., now he has the ability also to come out and submit the payments. So the problem here is, again, that separation of duties, segregation or separation of power. He has too much power. He can circumvent those controls. He can go around the controls and would now be able to create the company, the invoices, and the vendor payables, and pay himself money to this fictitious company. This is why separation of duties is such a big deal. Matter of fact, most of your large compliance or regulatory rules, such as SOX, JSOX, Basel, they all deal with this specific issue of separation of duties. Now, to understand why that's such a big deal, because it doesn't seem that big of a deal here, it's that when you get into the real mechanics of all these different roles with all these different people and all the different tasks, this becomes an enormous problem. It becomes
software systems and networks. Hello and welcome to Intypedia. We have learned many things about cipher systems and network security up to this date. Today we will see how a secret can be protected without using encryption systems. Join us.
Hi, today we will see how to design and carry out a protocol to protect a secret from possible loss, theft or damage. In particular, we will see how to protect a secret key that we have used to encrypt a document or the private key that we use to sign digitally.
Does that mean that if I lose my secret key, or if it gets damaged, I can recover it, or that I can prevent someone from stealing it, even if I have it hidden in my house? That would be fantastic.
Well, not exactly, Bob. What I mean is that you can take measures to avoid losing your secret keys or prevent someone from stealing them if you keep them somewhere that is not adequately protected. For this, there are protocols that allow a secret to be recovered from certain pieces of information that have been prepared previously. These are known as sharing protocols or secret sharing protocols. This doesn't mean sharing or distributing secrets with other people. It has to do with dividing the secret into many pieces in a way that will allow you to recover the secret later.
That sounds great, but I still don't understand it very well.
Don't worry, Bob. You'll see how easy it is. Let me show you in the next chapter. The original idea for recovering a secret is to divide it into several pieces so that if later on you have some of these pieces, not all of them necessarily, it is possible to recover the secret that had been hidden.
Let's see if I understand this. Suppose I have written my secret key on a piece of paper. What you are saying is that I have to break that paper into several pieces so that I will be able to recover the key just by gluing the pieces of the original paper back together again. In that case, it doesn't seem like a very bright idea.
The example you've given doesn't work because the method you suggest is too simple and insecure. In fact, it isn't a good method because it has several problems. For example, you won't be able to recover the key if you lose only one piece of paper. And if someone gets one of your pieces of paper, they will know part of your key. In practice, a protocol for sharing and distributing secrets is a cryptographic process that allows you to obtain a series of values or shadows from a given secret, so it is possible to recover the original secret using a previously specified number of those shadows, but impossible if there are fewer shadows.
If I've understood correctly, you mean shadows that are derived from the original secret, but are not part of the secret. Does that mean that the shadows don't contain pieces of the secret information like the pieces of paper that I mentioned earlier?
That's it. The aim is to obtain different values from the secret, so that these values don't give clues about the content of the secret. I haven't said anything about the size of the shadows. If the shadows are the same size as the secret, the protocol is said to be ideal. Furthermore, there is no need to use all the shadows that were generated initially in order to recover the secret. To be more precise, if in a secret sharing protocol n shadows are generated and we need k of them to recover the secret, the k is considered a threshold value and the protocol is called a k-n threshold protocol. In this way, if less than k shadows are known, that is, k-1 or less, it is impossible to recover the secret.
So, for example, if I use a 3-5 threshold protocol to share my password, I will obtain 5 shadows from my secret key and I will be able to recover the complete original key using any 3 shadows. Is that correct? Can I keep one shadow of my secret in my laptop, another on a flash drive, another at home, one more in the office, and the last one in a CD?
Of course. That way, if you lose the CD, for example, you won't lose the key. You would have only lost one of the shadows. and you could use any of the three remaining shadows to recover the secret. This way, your password is protected against loss, damage, and theft. An attacker won't be able to recover your password if they retrieve, in this example, two or fewer shadows.
Alice, you've convinced me about the usefulness of these protocols, but how are they used in practice? Are they complicated?
It's easy to understand. We'll take a look at an example in the next chapter. One of the easiest ways to conduct a secret sharing protocol is using polynomials as a mathematical tool. Although it's not the only way to do it, there are other ways, but they are more complicated.
Well, I think I can handle polynomials. They are very difficult, so please explain how they are used in secret sharing.
First of all, remember that a polynomial can be used to plot a curve through the points that verify this polynomial. Secondly, a polynomial of a fixed degree can be determined if we know the values that this polynomial takes on as many points as its degree value plus 1.
Other internal control strategies, like we say two-man controls, two individuals review and approve each other's work before the task is categorized as finished. And another case is, for example, do job rotation. So no single people can hold the same task, the same job permanently. You have to periodically to rotate their roles. Or mandatory vacation. Sometimes you just make a mandatory vacation of this employee. They're still employee, but make a vacation for this time window during which you can feed in other employees. This is also to ensure no people can keep in the same role for permanently to reduce the risk of information leakage. Or let's say we define the privilege and give the least image, or say just enough for use to ensure that no unnecessary access to data exists, and that only those individuals who must access the data do so, not any people else. And the last point, we might just remember this, we need to secure the personal data. It is not only the requirement of organization in many member states in EU, including Norway. It is actually required by law. And I don't think we have the time to go to this video clip for a security awareness training. So I shall leave this to you. Last year I used this material. So this year they have some update version to incorporate more recent information security threats like the ransomware, which was basically not very much heard from last year, but a lot heard from beginning of this year. They use different real-life examples and cartoons and visual illustrations, a lot of good ideas to compose this security awareness training program, which is very effective to impress the employees with information security concept, not limited to just several pages or papers. So this will be the last page of this lecture. And this also, as I mentioned, the last lecture of this course for this semester. And I believe yesterday afternoon you also have the last session of the practicals. So do remember the midnight today will be the deadline for the two course paper submission. And if I remember correctly, the city examination will be in December 20th, right? Yeah. And next Monday, I will share with you some examples. A lot of people, students ask what could be the typical questions in the final examination, and I will send some typical ones to you on Monday after I discuss this with Audin. So finally, I hope you enjoy the course, and I hope we can see in the next years, maybe in other courses in next years. So if you still have some feedback, I do encourage you to give me feedback or any comments or criticism or suggestions to this course, and just send me email or use the link I already shared with you. You can do this in an anonymized way. So thank you. This concludes this lecture and also conclude this course. But do remember, we will have a next lecture today in this room from 12:15. And I will strongly recommend you to stay here. And during this time window, you can just go to the cantina to grab some food. Okay, thank you.
Test. Good. Tester. Tester, tester. Hello. Good.
Hello? 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 Hello?